Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I'm especially excited this week, partly because Rory K. Smith is still away on his honeymoon, but more importantly, because Alison Rudd is back with us, James Scowcroft is back with us, and making his seasonal debut, the voice of the very faraway bits of Scotland and somewhere in the Northwest, it's Jonathan Northcroft from the Sunday Times. Coming up, we'll be talking some Manchester United, because Scully's here. We'll be talking some Villa and Remy Gardner. We're going to try to be helpful this week. We did talk about Villa last week, but now we've got a different cast of characters, far more intelligent people than we had on the podcast last week. So hopefully we'll come up with some good solutions. But there's only one place to start, and that's at Stamford Bridge.
Liverpool are still looking to get forward. Lallana lets it run through to Benteke. And here is Benteke, and it's another one. And Liverpool have surely won it now. And the speculation about Mourinho's future can only intensify.
All right, let's get this bit out of the way. I'm going to start with you, Johnny, because you're the biggest representative of the mainstream media here. So many newspapers wrote in the aftermath of Chelsea's last defeat that it was do or die, or sink or swim, which is a nicer way of putting it, for Jose Mourinho against Liverpool, and that if he lost, he'd be out. They lose, he's still there. For now, anyway. Can you just give us a little bit of insight and to our listeners, too, when we go and we report this stuff about what Abramovich wants to do? Because people ask me this, like, ultimately, we talk about boards and stuff like that. There's no board. It's just Abramovich deciding, yeah. Right?
It's the hardest thing, and I get asked the same questions, and ultimately, we're just guessing. We're guessing about, you know, one rich, changeable man's whims, really, and that's what we've been doing with Chelsea for years. So anyone that says they know exactly what the timescale is for Mourinho to be, you know, sacked or kept or whatever it is sort of lying, because it's a guess. It's a guess about what's going on inside Abramovich's head, but not only a guess about, you know, what's inside his head now, you're guessing about how he's going to react to certain things, his whim at a particular time. I think we're all just looking at his past behaviour, and on past behaviour he'd have sacked Jose Mourinho a long time before now. So, you know, it is clear that he's trying to do something different. I thought after the West Ham game that he wouldn't survive two more defeats, probably, but he has had two more defeats. And the sort of mood music coming out of Chelsea now is that he might actually get away with two more. You know, he might go into the international break, even if he loses to Kiev, even if he loses to Stoke, and still have a bit more time.
There are people at Chelsea, like at every club. Some of them, it's their job to go and tell you what the owner is thinking. Some of them are people who volunteer information. These are called sources. So, but the people I spoke to tell me that he's not going to make a decision based on results. He's going to take a more holistic view and look at performances and look at trouble within the squad and the dressing room and so on. And just because they win, if things blow up internally or they play badly, then he might go. And if they lose but play well, look, United, he might stay. And they really, they'd like to assess the situation in December. But I think we're in a situation where the sources themselves are sort of guessing themselves what Abramovich is going to do, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, that's what I'm hearing too in terms of the timescale. But at another club, any other club, there is a recognisable power structure. And you can, you know, even if you can't speak to the person right at the top of the power structure, you might be able to get close to other people, let's say in a board or a circle of advisors around an owner. But that's not the case at Chelsea, really, because it's not only Abramovich that's a closed-off source. He's got a tight, experienced circle of people who don't talk either and don't talk through other people. They don't let anything slip. So That is why it's a guess.
I want to throw this forward a little bit. I was set. So Sunday morning, Gary Richardson, for those who don't know who he is, he's, I guess, an older, highly respected gentleman who works for the BBC and does a show called Sports Week. He doesn't normally report on breaking news, but he came out with this line that I believe he spoke directly to a Chelsea player who said, and I quote, "I would rather lose than win for Mourinho," which I found completely incendiary. Now, we need to make this clear. This isn't some, you know, people often mock the media. They don't have much faith in the red tops and so on. They say they make things up or take fifth hand. Allison, you live in Barnes, which is where a lot of BBC people live, so you're qualified to answer this. Gary Richardson, him saying it is not like something, you know, it's not like a throwaway line. Like, it is understood in all these games that people play. Gary Richardson puts his credibility behind this quote, so it kind of matters more, right?
Well, yeah, but to be balanced about it, I think Gary was also highly excitable at the fact that someone had told him something and couldn't resist sharing that with the world. He did not let us know how significant this player was, or in the circumstances in which he might have been told him. If it was a player that had just been subbed or had some public criticism made of him and he caught him in a bad mood, that matters less than someone who's being picked regularly, who's sort of saying something that might reflect the general mood of the dressing
room. What's your understanding
of this? I don't think it's overly significant, unless you know who it was and the circumstances, well, that someone says that. Because you get that at every club.
Okay.
Because players are young and they get petulant and they get cross. And
uh-huh. So you've already dropped the hint, because I think we all know who it was. Do we know anything more about that? Because, like I said, I don't get up on Sunday mornings to listen to Gary Richardson because, Sunday Supplement is on and I'd rather hang out with Neil Ashton and Ollie Kay. But I want to understand from you, is this something the player actually said to him, or is it something that he overheard, he was hiding in the bushes, and is this something that was relayed to him second? Do we know any of this?
No, I don't know why I've got the impression. I've got the impression that it wasn't firsthand. I got the impression there was a middleman, but you seem to have got the impression it was direct.
I don't have any impression. I'm just going by what's written in the newspapers. I haven't spoken to Gary Richardson. Scully, from your perspective, we hear about this a lot. Like, players, you know, they want to play for the manager. It's difficult for me to understand because while none of us have been professional footballers, we've all had bosses, and there's some bosses we like and some bosses we like less, and some might inspire us more. But at least speaking for myself, I've never gone out and done a half-assed job intentionally to try and get my boss fired. Have you seen that happen in football?
No, and I don't think it does happen in football. I think, without doubt, you know, when people say they've lost a change room, that does happen.
No, specifically this playing for the manager thing.
No. That's because ultimately it's a short career. You have to play for yourself. You know, if you're going out there thinking, well, I like this manager, I'll play for him, or I don't like, so I won't play for this manager, there's only one person you're cheating, and that's yourself. So I don't believe that. I'm not sure where the quotes come from and who the player is, but I just don't buy into that at all. But it does seem to me that he does have problems behind the scenes with certain players.
Let's move on to the game itself. Let's quickly dispense with what I thought were the two controversial decisions, and we'll go to our qualified ref for that. Should Lucas have been sent off?
No.
No?
No.
The
first offence was a yellow card. That's not up for discussion, I don't think, particularly. The second one, I do feel Ramirez was on his way down anyway, and I did see Lucas, he did, as he indicated afterwards, he did sort of try and back off the challenge. It was, if he had been booked, it wouldn't be the most ridiculous decision, but I certainly don't think it was shoe-in yellow, that, at all.
What about Diego Costa kicking out at Skrtel?
Well, with hindsight, that's a red card. But I can also see why Clattenburg couldn't be sure that it was deliberate at the time. And it requires Clattenburg to request that is reviewed, because he's in his report, he's going to say that he saw it, and he saw it as accidental. Because no one was hurt, I think he's starting to get into opening up pages and pages and pages of reviews that don't really matter. So I don't think he will get a retrospective red for that.
Scully, situations like that, when you're playing, you know, as an attacking player, and you get some big old nasty centre half clattering you, I don't know, Jerry Taggart or something, and you kind of fall to the ground, Are you ever tempted to give him a little swift one? Is it, how easy is it to do it and get away? In your opinion, is that what Costa
not
did?
Not to Jerry Taggett, I wouldn't do it. I have done it to other people.
You and have? Like, what, well,
caught
occasionally
and been red carded, and I've got away with it at times.
Really?
Yeah.
Did it look intentional to you? I mean, given it, if sort of about a minute before that, the two of them were sort of clashing and shouting at each other on the touchline.
So, well, it's intentional, isn't it?
It is intentional.
Yeah. It's,
all right. Okay.
Do you not think so? If you kick out somebody, oh, it's not, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
But that's interesting. So when you played James, did you think, oh, I don't think anyone's going to see that? Because you knew there weren't cameras everywhere. And you know, there was a 50-50 chance it wouldn't be seen. Yeah. Whereas today, do you think players...
A favourite one of mine...
Go into a match knowing that everything's visible.
Yeah, without doubt. I think players these days are... You know, they have to be so careful what they do. You know,
but they still do stupid things.
Do
you forget as soon as the whistle goes? Do you stop thinking about surveillance?
It's a hit at the moment, isn't it? A favourite of mine was corner kicks standing on people's toes, because you could get away with that one, and that was very painful.
Especially when you're a bigger boy like you.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we've got all the dark arts of Scowcroft. All right, I'm going to turn this around. We've all seen Mourinho after the game. Funnily enough, in the, you know, when they do post-match interviews, they also do some for the, I guess it's the international feed, where he was actually a lot more loquacious than he was with Guy Mowbray and with Sky. He did actually talk there, and rather than the, you know, I can't talk. I mean, look at it from Mourinho's perspective. They score that goal, and I am playing devil's advocate here, or Mourinho's advocate. They score that goal, you know, well after the minimum of 2 minutes have expired. There is the Lucas should have been sent off argument. There's the fact that two of Liverpool's three goals were deflected. Does he have any kind of a case that in reality they were once again victims of the campaign against him, or is he just being silly?
I think he's conflating two things. You know, bad luck and agendas against them. They are in a weird run, Chelsea. To be fair to them, since the season started, they have been on the wrong end of either bad bits of luck or decisions. Not exclusively, though, because they've benefited as well, and they've benefited from Costa staying on the field. But, you know, on balance, they've probably had more things go against them than for them. But what Mourinho does, because it's part of his psychology, is to make this leap to it being part of an anti-him agenda, because, you know, for whatever reason, people don't like him, people don't like Chelsea's success, whatever he thinks it is. And it's just arrant nonsense. And he does the same thing when it comes to the media. You know, he sat in, I mean, he was quite loquacious in the end in his written press conference, and it finished with him offering, and I actually thought it was a great line, but it also shows how he thinks. You know, he said in the end, if you can't see what's happening to me and to us, you know, at my next press conference, I'll arrive and, you know, bring you all nice pairs of glasses, and then give you each 5% of a personality so that you can stand up and write the truth. Which, you know, it's fun, but he thinks that. He thinks that we're part of some sort of conspiracy and that we love to see Chelsea fail. And you know, there might be a couple of Arsenal supporting journalists that are enjoying it. There might, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I do not detect any kind of widespread glee about Chelsea failing per se. What is fun, of course, for us is new stories, things that we haven't seen happen before.
Mourinho this season is doing something which I think is really counterintuitive from top managers, and I haven't seen Mourinho do before. Mourinho's always been about his biggest stars and rallying around them and backing them and making them feel special. Arguably last season, Chelsea's four most important players were Courtois, who's now injured, Terry, who was dropped earlier this year, Matic, who disappeared to the bench, he was on the bench again on Saturday, and Hazard, who admittedly was pretty awful against Liverpool, but then was substituted. Scully, I get from talking to managers that, you know, if you're a manager, you're kind of at the mercy of your top players, and that's why you stick through them even when they're playing badly. And certainly, looking at Wayne Rooney at United, that seems to be the case. He's gone completely in the opposite direction. I mean, can you just give us a bit of a perspective on that? And you must have played on teams that had one or two superstars that were much better than the rest of you. Or maybe you were one of those two. But how did it feel when they were on a bad run and the manager wouldn't drop them, would he?
No, he wouldn't, no.
It's unusual anyway. Yeah. It's counterintuitive.
Because they're not only key players, they're big characters. Usually your key players are your big characters in the dressing room as well. So if you drop them, it's hard for me to mention names here, but if you're dropping players that have probably played the last 60, 70 games consecutive as well, they're not going to be very happy. Their pride's going to be dented. They'll sulk about. So there's numerous different factors that come into it, really. So I'm surprised.
Sorry, James, to interrupt. But it's not that he's dropped players. And in a way, I think we're wrong to criticise him for doing that, because I criticise him for never rotating last season. And this is part of the problem why we're all so knackered now. There's nothing wrong with rotating. And if that rotation includes a star player, and you could argue most of them are stars at Chelsea, that's not, in itself not wrong. What is baffling and counterintuitive, Gab, is that he takes a player like Matic. He doesn't just drop him, he goes public with the psychoanalysis of that player and says he's forgotten how to play football. He needs to keep it simple, because if he makes a mistake, his whole game is ruined. If you are Matic and you are one of the stoic star performers of the previous title-winning season, you are told publicly, everyone now knows, that you crumble if you make a mistake, and therefore don't do anything clever.
He did the same with Hazard as well, didn't he? He's not working hard enough. Is that we got? As a man, is he going to get the best out of his players by doing that? No, he's not.
I want to move on to Klopp, because of course Liverpool won it five times.
Were Liverpool playing as well, Gab?
I believe so.
That's how relevant they are,
Johnny. We can see that Klopp is fun on the sidelines and everything. I thought that what he said after the game, when he said, you know, we deserve to win, but we can play much, much, much better. I thought he hit the nail on the head. I don't think that this is Klopp's team. I don't think we're going to see a Klopp Liverpool until next season, once they get the movement and the mechanisms right and the fitness right and whatever else. And right now, it's really just about getting results, moving forward, assessing your players. Am I wrong?
No, I agree. I mean, what's exciting for Liverpool is there's a change already, and this is with a fairly, I would say, ordinary group of players, and with no time to really work with them. So you can see down the line, with better players and more time, something really exciting happening. The real improvement for me is what's happening with the ball. It took Liverpool a couple of games really to grasp that this guy is about more than just, you know, let's all run around a lot. Of course that's part of it, but it's more sophisticated than that. And they're starting to get that combination of pressing hard, putting in the effort when they don't have possession, but then when they get it, actually thinking a little bit and playing with a bit of pattern. I thought there was some clever tactics involved. I don't know if it was Klopp or Buvac's assistant that came up with it, but they decided to target Azpilicueta down the left, and I mean, I think all three goals came from balls into his area, and him being unable to stop the player either coming inside or crossing it or winning a header in the case of Benteke for the second. You know, the more he gets to know the league, the more he'll be able to come up with things like that.
Scully, who's going to finish higher this season, Chelsea or Liverpool?
It's a very good question.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't really buy into this one win at Stamford Bridge and Klopp's a genius, tactical master, blah, blah, blah.
I know you want to see them both relegated, but who do you think will finish higher?
Well, ask him if he'll be relegated.
I think Chelsea will.
You think Chelsea will finish above Liverpool?
Yeah.
Moving on to Palace and Manchester United. It's the umpteenth 0-0 from United. The umpteenth, I thought, generally fairly unimpressive performance, certainly going forward. I want to start with Van Gaal and Scholes, because for those who haven't followed this, Scholes has come out and said that he finds the way Manchester United play boring. You know, sideways passing, blah, 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 not many shots on goal. And I thought Van Gaal's reaction to this was absolutely extraordinary. I don't know, it seemed like something out of the Godfather movie. He's like, well, you should talk to your friend Ryan Giggs, who, of course, is his assistant. You know, it was almost as if Scholes is some kind of Judas Iscariot for going and criticizing Manchester United and implying that Scholes is paid to say this. Johnny, I thought it was profoundly hypocritical of Van Gaal, because I remember a tall, full-faced Dutch manager who, in between his stints in managing Ajax and Barcelona and Bayern and Holland, was a pundit on Dutch television. Mm. Not only was he a pundit, he was an incredibly outspoken pundit who fell out publicly with a whole raft of Dutch managers because he was so critical. And those guys, I might add, were his colleagues. What's Van Gaal doing? Does he not get this, or is he just kind of like in Louis Land? Or?
Oh, he's in Louis Land, isn't he? But, you know, when he was at Ajax, in the... Now, I forget his job title, but, you know, when he was...
As technical, he was there as manager, and then he was there as technical director.
As the technical director.
In 2004, I think.
Yeah, now, he was basically ousted by the cabal of you know, Cruyff disciples and the ex-players. So he's had experience before of being at a club where he was an outsider in a way. I know he'd been manager there, but he wasn't part of the golden, you know, circle tradition of the club, where the voices from, you know, ex-players, legends, and he, you know, nobody, I've never heard the word legend said dismissively until Van Gaal started saying it in reference to schools. But, you know, he's had experience of this before, and they kind of forced him out there. And I thought his reaction to it showed that it has touched a nerve. He's thin-skinned, despite being the man of the strongest opinions. The funny thing is, when you listen to him, ask him what he wants from his team, he actually says the same things that Scholes is saying. He talks about not being satisfied with how they're playing. He talks about wanting to see more speed and tempo and you know, more attacking play. So it almost sounds like he's on the same page until you get to the point where the dividing line is Scholes wants freedom and expression, and he doesn't want that. So he seems to think that he can have the quick, exciting, attacking play, but robotically to order rather than with the expression. I actually think it's a very small difference of opinion, but a very fundamental one.
Can you give us a little bit of insight into this? Because obviously you made the transition. You were a very important player for Ipswich and Leicester. And then you move into the media, and I'm assuming specifically those clubs, in local media and so on, people ask you your opinions. Is there ever an issue of loyalty versus the club versus speaking your mind? How do you negotiate that? Is that something you think Scholes has struggled with? And loyalty to his friend, Giggs, who, of course, was...
Well, I think if you look at the bigger picture, you know, this isn't the first time Scholes has criticised Van Gaal or the club. It's, you know, in his column, he did it every other week almost on his TV work. He's not shy to say what he thinks. But if you look at it, and if you see the documentary last week with the Class of 92, with Salford City, he's obviously close to Giggs. I'm sure he speaks to Giggs on a regular basis. So there's obviously messages coming, and there's some kind of, you know, this is the way I look at it, that if everything was perfect behind the scenes and Giggs was telling me, you know, you've got to see this bloke work, you know, this is something tactically, he's a genius. I don't think Scholes would be coming out and saying this.
Really?
I don't think Ryan Giggs is feeding Scholes stuff and, oh, can you say this, can you say
but
that?
But it's not a case of Scholes just sitting there watching from his... No. I believe he's, like you, he's a season ticket holder at Old Trafford. It's not a case of just him just sitting there watching, like, oh, this is all rubbish.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He actually goes and... Obviously, he speaks to people at the club, former teammates, assistant manager who he's very close to, and that helps formulate his opinion. So he's actually giving you an informed opinion, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think he's well informed, isn't he, about what's going on. Not only he can see, he's a very intelligent person, very intelligent player.
Is he really?
You know, from what he speaks, I think so. And speaking to other people as well, I don't think all is well behind the scenes with Mr. Van Gaal.
Alison, I want to talk about Palace a little bit, because unless do we need to talk about United more?
No.
I mean, I want to give an opinion on Rooney, what's wrong? You take Rooney out back and like do what they do with horses who are lame, right? Scully?
It's a big problem, Rooney, at the moment. He needs to be
doing as he's told? That's the other thing. The formation written down in all the papers over the weekend and today is that he's playing up front. He didn't play up front. He doesn't. He's always dropping deep.
Well, he drops deep because he never touches the ball, because they've got 85 sideways passes before anyone gets their head up and looks at him.
Why don't United play with a good striker and let Rooney be dropped or play officially?
Well, they've got one, but he's now playing on the left wing.
Well, exactly. Are people not doing what they're told, or is this part of some sort of clever strategy?
I think he's doing what he's told. He's just not doing it very well.
Scholes' best line on United was that they look like the type of team you wouldn't want to play for, but you wouldn't want to play against them either. And I think that absolutely sums them up. They are hard to play against. They've got a brilliant structure, and at a time when nobody else in the league is defending particularly well and particularly hard to play against. You know, maybe with the exception of Tottenham, I suppose you could say, pretty horrible to play against. But there's a huge foundation there, and I would say that I think James is right. It's not the happiest that United squad's ever been. But if Van Gaal could free things up a little bit up front and put Martial in the number 9 position, given the foundation they've got, I think they've got a real opportunity. So that would be my positive about United. The big if is...
He needs to drop changed. Rooney, Jonathan, he does. He needs to give him a break.
Yeah.
He needs to give him a month where he just comes off the last 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Get him going, get a little bit of hunger back in his game. I'm sure he'll have another, 18 months, 2 years in his career where he'll do well again.
We want to talk some Palace and your pal, Alan Pardew, who's so beloved on Merseyside, of course. It's a good result. It's a draw at home with United. They're there. I look at the way they're playing this year, and obviously his run's been tremendous, and he has these sort of fast attacking midfielder, winger, forward hybrid types, and it seems to and nobody seems to know how to handle playing against them. Every time they just get the ball, they just start running, and then they get fouled or they run past you. He makes it look really, really easy and simple. But there's more to it than that, right? There is some more planning rather than getting all these roadrunners out there.
It's quick reactions. You're always dissing Alan Pardew, but he's a good tactical coach, and he's very he's more open and honest about what goes on in the training ground than a lot of managers you chat to. And he says this season it's all about if you win possession or if the opposition lose possession or you win it. And so he's now got Kabai, who will instantly turn the winning of that possession, sort of hoofing it or just getting rid of the ball.
Transition.
He immediately turns into something very, very clever. So he'll find one of those very many pacey players there are. And they are blessed with a lot of pace. And he'll play a pretty decent ball into the path of someone like Zahar or Bolasie or someone. Immediately, the other team, they cannot react quickly to that. And there was a clue, because Van Gaal said after the game they had the momentum. United couldn't get going the way that Palace could, because Palace can restart. It doesn't matter. They can suffer a period where the other team does have some possession, is playing perhaps more accomplished passing football, but as soon as they win the ball, they do something intelligent and pacey with it. That's what it's about. A lot of it's about the fact he managed to attract Johan Kabai. He's crucial in that.
£100,000 a week helped as well. But
yeah, and moving to London, and he wasn't getting a game at PSG. Scully, it's interesting, because I was wondering about that. Obviously, you can do that if you have Kabai. Kabai has a special skill set. And I was wondering, could somebody else replicate? Like, I was thinking actually Swansea, right? If we think of Jonjo Shelvey as sort of an off-brand Johan Kabai, could they do that? And you could get Montero and whatnot just running like maniacs and in transition and get... I mean, is this something you can replicate, or does it actually require... A tremendous amount of tactical work and cohesion and stuff like that.
I wouldn't say it's tactical. You need pace in wide areas, which Palace have had now for the last two seasons, and it's been their main, especially away from home, counter-attacking teams. People like Bolasie and Zaha can get you up the pitch 50, 60 yards within seconds, and a lot of teams defend deep and they will concede space in behind. What's interesting for Palace, and, I think Alan Pardew is doing a good job. They should have won at the weekend. They've only scored one goal from open play since August. So you think when they see attacking...
So Pardew's actually really, really bad. One goal from Auckland Place. Rubbish.
He hasn't been able to get a good centre forward.
I jest, of course. Moving on to our debate this week. I think it's official now. Remy Gard is the new Aston Villa manager. We can say that without looking stupid. Thank you. Johnny, I want to start with you because we talked about this last week, and without going into the actual specifics and merits of Remy Gard and whatever else, there was a sense of what do Villa stand for? What do they need, like a mission statement in terms of what they're going to do? Because you've got, you have a club that obviously won the European Cup. You have a club with a really sizable fan base that has kind of been treading water for a long time. Should the idea be to build a foundation and try to break into the top four? Do you go with youth? Do you just kind of try to steer the ship until Lerner can sell the club? How do you see it?
They should have an aim, but they don't. And let's start with the last thing you said. Lerner, it's an open secret. It's not even a secret. It has been trying to sell the club for a long time and has pulled out the investment. So if you look at the budget, I think they've got the ninth biggest budget in the Premier League. So they're right bang around the middle, and it's been slipping. And actually, their budget isn't really... It might be ninth, but it's only slightly bigger than your Crystal Palace and Swansea sort of level. So there's been a financial drop-off, and yet the ambitions of the fans, the prestige of the club hasn't changed that much. So to me, it's a club that looked caught because... 4 or 5 years ago, there was a clear mission statement, which was to try and join the top four or five, and to try and be maybe in that echelon with Tottenham and Everton of the next best clubs. Now it's a club treading water until the owner sells it, which every time it tries to plan for something or build something, it gets into trouble, has to sack the manager, and start again.
But Johnny, sorry if I jump in there. Sorry. You mentioned Spurs and Everton, right? One difference is that Spurs and Everton generally either break even in the transfer market or make money. This wonderfully ambitious spell with your pal Martin O'Neill saw them spend enormous amounts of money every year, Lerner writing massive checks. And when he said, well, hang on a minute, why are you making me spend all this money every single year? I've got enough Chris Suttons here. It all kind of stopped, right?
Yeah.
So they weren't able to retrench and do the job that Everton and Spurs do, which is being competitive while breaking even.
Well, if you're going to try and be competitive and break even, as to be competitive as it relates to your club. So, Villa, to be competitive in the minds of their fans, I suppose, is being a top 5, 6, 7, 8, that brand.
Like Everton and Spurs.
Yeah, so you have to have a good manager because that's the only way to do it. Financially, if you're going to try and achieve over what your budget's saying, then of course you've got to have a good and special manager. That's clearly the difference between Villa in the last 4 or 5 years and let's just take Everton. Tottenham, I think, slightly more complicated because of the Gareth Bale windfall, having him as a player and then being able to sell him for the money that they did. But they've also had good managers. But if you compare them to Everton, Everton have had David Moyes, who built a club over 10, 11 years, and a very good success in Martinez.
Villa have had two Scottish managers as well, Lambert and McLeish. Are you saying that Scots aren't good? Do you have some sort of anti-Scottish bias here?
Of course not. Yes.
Is it because you're not from Aberdeen?
Yeah. No, McLeish and Lambert are good managers in their own ways, but have they managed at the level of top end of the Premier League? No, they haven't. Are they capable of it? Well, they would need a bit of time to get there, like David Moyes needed time to get there, and they weren't given that time. You've either got to give the guy time, or you've got to have it. You've got to appoint somebody who is of that bracket, and Villa have done neither. And to come back to where we started, I think the managers there haven't quite known what their brief is. Am I trying to stay in the league here? Am I trying to entertain? Am I trying to finish in the top 6 or 7? And there's a disconnect between them and the owner and them and, now there's a director of football and chief scout signing players. So it is a dysfunctional club that doesn't quite know what it's trying to do.
Right. So Remy Gard's a guy who won a lot of praise at Lyon, obviously. He came to Arsenal when he was quite old, and I think hardly played. Then he went back a different
coaching jobs. Leon actually became very good once he was gone, but he certainly laid the foundation, got credit for that. Are you disappointed that, as somebody who's English and who has coaching badges, that...
It wasn't you.
Thank you, Alison. No, are you disappointed that they didn't, you know, look in the lower divisions, look at that they said, right, you know, this isn't even an issue for us. We're going to look beyond these shores.
Yeah, naturally. You know, you look at it and it is a problem, really. I think if you're... Harry Redknapp said it last week. If you're a lower league manager, there's no carrot there anymore, is there? To get into the Premiership, unless you get promoted with a team, it is nigh on impossible now to be promoted. You know, is Remy Gard so much better than some of the... Well, you look across, you know, Birmingham, you know, it would never happen, but Gary Rowett at Birmingham, the job he's done there at the moment, you know, with nothing... I think they've got to come as a Swansea or Southampton first before they can become a... You know, there's just no philosophy there. There's
but
no style.
Though. Hang on, though. You're saying, it's interesting you said that, because you said you want to become a Swansea or Southampton, right? Which we both agree are very well-run clubs who seem to do well regardless who the manager is, and they have a very strong structure in place. Well, if I were Tom Fox, I'd be like, hey, Scully, that's what I did, right? I got this Almstad guy from Arsenal, right? Good team. He's my director of football or whatever his title is. I brought in a chief scout. The idea is that we're going to have a well-run club. It's not all going to be down to the whim of the manager and you know, ringing up his agent, be like, oh, I need a right back and whatever else, right? So that's good, right?
If it works.
Villa are trapped because you can't become a Swansea or a Southampton if you're Aston Villa, because the fans stay away. The fans that do go boo or show their dissatisfaction, which means you inevitably get a panic if you're the owner that you're going to start losing revenue, that it'll spiral out of control and it won't be a difficult place to go to, and you're going to get relegated. So you'll go for a short fix to stop that happening and try and get some bums on seats. It will take the new owner, whoever the new owner is, to come in with
well,
that sort
he,
of
if
vision.
He comes. But we don't know that we're ever going to get a new
exactly,
owner.
Exactly. That's what it'll take.
But it looks to me, though, Johnny, as if Lerner saying, all right, well, obviously, I'm sure he'd like to sell the club. It's my understanding that he came close in the summer. But at least he says, while I have the club, I'm going to try to make it a well-run club, a club that's not entirely in hock to the manager. Because obviously that's the issue, right, for clubs that size. If you make it all about the manager,
yeah,
and he does well, then the manager is going to leave and move on to a bigger club, right? That's what always happens. He's either good and he leaves you for somebody better, or he's rubbish and then so you kick him out. Unless you're David Moyes, in which case you stick around forever.
Yeah.
But you know, Moyes, I think we agree, is an outlier.
Yeah, but there's nothing wrong with the model. You know, I'm all on board with the model. There's nothing wrong with that. But Almstad, the sporting director, arrived in July. You know, Paddy Riley, the head of recruitment, whatever he is, arrived late last year. So they haven't given it long to work before changing a manager. Sherwood was only appointed in, what was it, February, March last year. This is the problem with Villa. It's not staying the course. It's not laying down something and then, you know, committing to it. It's always getting caught in the trap of panicking about Premier League status and then switching and having to try and do something else. So, you know, I would take on board that yeah, you know, Randy Lerner's got this great structure, this great plan. Tom Fox is you know, building something sensible, if they actually stuck to it. But they don't stick to it. And I kind of feel they do that with signings and squad building as well. I mean, to appoint Tim Sherwood, you know, the archetypal, let's say, English in terms of philosophy manager, but then to recruit a whole lot of French players is it's just disconnected, isn't it?
For those of us who, as much as we love the Premier League, it's always the same freaking five or six teams near the top. So I think some fresh air might actually be good. I speak for myself anyway, when I hope Villa come back, not just to Tottenham or Liverpool status. Oh, can I share one last little funny Villa anecdote? I know the people look after Adama Traore, and as you probably know, it was down to Stoke or Villa. Basically, they offered the same amount of money, same deals, and he literally went for a weekend. He went to Stoke and he went to Villa, and he said, I'll decide based on that. And people kind of assumed, right, well, he's going to go to Stoke because you know, Adama Traore is from Barcelona. He was born and raised like a block from the Camp Nou. They have all these former Barcelona guys, Muñeza and Ben Boyan and whatever else. Mark Hughes, of course, lived in Barcelona as well a long time ago. Whereas at Villa, you know, you've got all these French guys and Tim Sherwood and whatever else. And no, he chose Villa. And do you know why, Alison?
The gilet. It's French.
No. Adama Traoré is Spanish. He's not French.
But he likes
Gilets. No, he does not. He doesn't wear gilets. That's very few people can pull it off. No, he showed up at Villa Park and he arrived sort of in the afternoon, and it was a rare summer's day in the Midlands. And he just looked at the stadium and he just stood there for like a few minutes, and he said it looks like a castle. And he saw it sort of, you know how like Villa Park sort of towers over it. And he says, like, I want to play here. And this is a guy who, you know, growing up, sort of looked out his window and saw the Camp Nou every day. Moving on to some quick hits. Manchester City squeaked past Norwich 2-1 in a game marked by some horrific goalkeeping blunders from Hart and Ruddy. Kolarov, to be fair, also missed a penalty. So is there something to be concerned about if you're City, Alison, or nothing?
Well, it was a 3-1 game, really, apart from the missed penalty, wasn't it? And Joe Hart is an excellent goalkeeper who's allowed to occasionally make those stupid mistakes. So given that they were off colour and a bit sulky, then I think it's actually quite good news that they can win. The more worrying is that Norwich lose when they're playing well and they lose when they're playing badly.
I think Norwich will be just fine in the end. I like their manager, who happens to continue the great tradition of Scottish managers. Arsenal win 3-0 at Swansea and Mesut Ozil delivers two sparkling assists. Johnny, I'm sure that, like me, you read Matthew Syed's appreciation of Ozil's assist ability a few weeks back. But tell me, why does Ozil occasionally get stick? Should he be doing more? I mean, is there a level of expectation with when you've got a fee like that?
He gets stick because we decide as a country, as a media, I think we decide things very early. So, you know, we've decided Anthony Martial's an absolute world beater, which he probably is, because he did well straight away. Ozil didn't. So he's stuck in that. He doesn't score enough goals. We like goals from midfielders. We don't see other things. And he's a bit languid. But yeah, we've got to change our minds about him.
Speaking of Swansea, they actually played rather well before the bottom fell out. And if Gomis had buried that early chance, maybe the game would have taken a different turn. Plus, I'm not really sure why Koscielny's goal was allowed to stand. James, you'll probably tell me that goalkeepers get too much protection.
They do, yeah. I thought the goal was okay. He stood his ground. Koscielny made a bit of a hash of it.
He touched the keeper, though.
And?
I'm kidding.
It's a contact sport.
So you're fine. It's totally
goal.
Cool. All right. Okay. Everton ride roughshod over Sunderland on their way to a 6-2 win. Alison, your call. You can either talk about Kone's hat trick or, more impressively, De Lufeu's delightful assist.
I'd like to talk about De Lufeu because he's in danger of becoming so good that people learn how to pronounce his name properly. It's taken him a while. He came and then he went again and he's come back. And I saw him against Arsenal and thought, this is the player I hoped he would be.
So who's laughing at Crazy Claudio now? Leicester beat West Brom 3-2. Jamie Vardy makes it 8 on the bounce, and they're now third. Let me repeat that. Third. Automatic qualification to the Champions League. Plus, they also have king power, which matters too. Johnny, what's more remarkable, Vardy's run or the fact that Leicester are third automatic qualification to the Champions League?
Vardy's improved every year of his career, so that's not as surprising as the team as a whole. I'm amazed that people like Mahrez and Albrighton are so consistent because they haven't been throughout their careers. And I thought the slump was coming with Leicester. It's not, so that's a surprising thing.
Meanwhile, newly promoted Watford beat West Ham and they're now 1 point away from sixth place. This despite the million new signings, the lack of Premier League experience, the four managers last year, despite the fact that, let me point this out, one manager quit, another manager had a heart attack, and another manager was an interim manager anyway. And also, of course, the fact that nobody seemed to know who Kike Sanchez Flores was. And, would his English be good enough? Are you impressed, Scully?
Very impressed, actually. I think they've gone about their business really well. Watford, great result for them at the weekend. I think Bilic has even praised them that they worked extremely hard. And a big shout to my former teammate, Ben Watson, who's come back from a horrendous leg break and is doing extremely well in their midfield.
I actually got into this with Twitter on somebody who said, like, well, no, we have plenty of Premier League experience. So look at Watson and Gomez. Watson, I think, is Watson and Gomez are the only guys who, you know, who actually have extensive Premier League experience. And even then, that was mostly a long time ago. And in Watson's case, at Wigan, so it doesn't really count.
I'm not sure about Kike Flores' knitwear, though.
Can I say something about that guy? He's cool.
No, his jackets aren't.
I know, but he can pull it off. You know why?
No, he can't.
Because, no, you know why? Because Kike Sanchez Flores, if he were English, you would describe him as posh because he grew up with money. He grew up with... He's from a different class. He's like, in the same way you guys have this fascination with your royalty and you allow them to be eccentric and weird and do weird things, and then you all go watch Downton. It's the same thing. Kike is the Spanish version of that.
I don't like his jacket. Gab, one for you. It was first v second in Serie A, Inter hosting Roma. How did it work out for the lovely Mancini?
Inter won 1-0. It's their sixth 1-0 victory of the season. They continue... Especially this season. They continue playing badly and winning. Mancini made some big calls. He dropped Mauro Icardi for this game, changed his fullbacks around. They got absolutely hammered. Handanovic was man of the match, and they snuck away with a 1-0 victory. My warning to Bobby Mank is it does matter how you play, so please fix it. Don't just rest on your 1-0 laurels. Right, that's all we've got time for this week, which is a shame because we had three really, really good guests this week, and their names are James Scowcroft, Alison Rudd, and making his debut, but hopefully he'll be back again before next season, Johnny Northcroft. Please press that subscribe button. We're going to be back next week. And if you subscribe to the paper as well, you'll get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. Till next time, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.